Hello and welcome to the Essential Classics guest interview with me, Sarah Walker. I was joined in the studio this week by Jeanette Winterson, a passionate speaker, engaged with all the arts, not just literature, but opera, orchestral music, painting, the gentle art of playing the piano in the front room. And she tells me how her adoptive mother used to play a lot, and she shares many colourful anecdotes about growing up in Accrington and her lifelong quest for identity. If you'd like to hear Jeanette's classical music choices in full, you can do so via the BBC Playlister. There's a link on the Essential Classics homepage. So here are my conversations with Jeanette Winterson. Hope you enjoy them. You're listening to Essential Classics on BBC Radio 3 with me, Sarah Walker. My guest this week, choosing some of her favourite classical music, is a writer whose first novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, was an immediate bestseller. Since then, she's published many more novels, a memoir, non-fiction and children's books. And her latest book, The Gap of Time, has just been published. She's Jeanette Winterson. Jeanette, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you said in your memoir that when you were at school, you realised you were only good at one thing, and that was words. And yet there were hardly any books in your house when you were growing up. So how did you manage to acquire that skill with words?
I think there were two routes. One was the King James Bible, which my mother, the late Mrs. Winterson, read to us standing up every morning and every evening. She'd start at the book of Genesis and go right the way through to Revelations. And then that was her favourite because, you know, the world gets blown up and she always wanted things to be destroyed. And then she'd give us 2 weeks off to think about things and then we'd start again, right back to the beginning. So, you know, if you hear those cadences every day, you know, that's a good grounding in language. And of course, it makes Shakespeare extremely simple. Because 1611, the King James Bible, that's the language of Shakespeare. And more important than the actual vocabulary is that sense of cadence, rhythm, the pace of it. And that's why, you know, you have working men's extension lectures up in the north of England and they went and studied Shakespeare. No problem. The language to them was the language of the Bible that they heard in church on Sundays.
That's interesting that you use the words cadence and rhythm, so sort of very musical way.
Absolutely, it is musical because, you know, words begin in the mouth before they hit the page. Everything starts as an oral tradition, and that was my other route to language. You know, not a bookish or an educated family, no particular interest there, but high level of spoken English. You know, working class culture, especially then in the 60s. You know, it was robust, it was muscular. It hadn't been homogenised by television. You know, people could speak well. You know, but with dignity and vivid expression. And that's what I heard. So the language of the streets, the language of the Bible, and then, of course, my own reading. And this sense that, you know, it's about texture. Look, when we speak, first of all, from breath. And that's singing, you know, and I think that's why I love the human voice, which so many of my choices use the human voice, because, you know, it's all to me a kind of song, whether or not there's music behind it.
Well, after your difficult beginnings in Accrington, your path led you to Oxford University, where you studied English. And later on, there was a trip to New York, wasn't there, that you've said opened up new doors for you. And you heard the first piece you've chosen for us today, The Agnus Dei by Samuel Barber. So what were you doing in New York?
It was the time I'd just written Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, and it had been a big success. And the publishing house at the time said, you know, do you want to come on board and help us find other new young writers? Which was a great brief. And part of it was going to New York. So I went there. I'd never seen such a city. You know, it was like a vertical Babylon, an invented place. Always seemed to be much more exciting than Venice. You know, it was an invented city, somewhere that couldn't really exist but did. And I think I was walking down somewhere quite expensive, like Fifth Avenue, and the windows were open and I heard the Samuel Barber coming out through the window. I have no idea what it was, but it felt like spiritual music. I then later heard that it was. I knew that it was. But suddenly hearing that cascading out down onto those busy New York streets above the mundane, above the realities of getting and spending, the reality of the spirit and looking up at these soaring skyscrapers, to me now that's New York.
Well, I think we should hear that piece now. Barber's Agnus Dei, the choral version of his Adagio for strings. And it's performed on this recording by Polyphony, conducted by Stephen Layton.
Thank you.
Barber's Agnus Dei, the choral version of his Adagio for strings, and it was performed on that recording by Polyphony, conducted by Stephen Layton. That's music that brings back memories of New York City for my guest Jeanette Winterson. You do love the human voice a lot, don't you, Jeanette?
I adore it. In all its different timbres and qualities, you know, it seems to me, the essential sense of being human, and because we speak to each other, you know, animals don't. And it's not so much what people say, is it? You know, we often blank that out, but it's the tone of their voice. Certainly with little children before language, you know, it's how something is said, not what is said. And perhaps we often overlook that.
Yes, and definitely that piece works so beautifully for voices, even though that's not the original version. But thank you for choosing that. I mentioned your memoir in my introduction. It's called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. Now, this was Mrs. Winterson's phrase, your adoptive mother. Do you recall the moment she said it to you and how it struck you?
She was a monster, but she was my monster. Yes, I was leaving home at 16 because I had an affair with another woman, and obviously if you're brought up as an evangelical Christian, this isn't the best idea. And so she'd said to me, look, either you give up the girl or you leave home. That was the choice. Well, what would you do? So I decided I was going. You know, I was doing my A-levels. I didn't know where I was going. I spent that night actually up on the bowling green in one of the shelters, and then later I lived in a mini for a bit. But I knew that I had to go, and the whole place was just too oppressive and difficult. So I was going down this dark, narrow, cramped lobby, and she suddenly said to me, Jeanette, you know, why are you doing this? And I thought perhaps we could talk, because we'd always been on either side of a pane of glass, really, and almost making signs through it rather than speaking. And I said to her, look, I don't know, but it makes me happy. And there was a long pause, and then she said, why be happy when you could be normal? And that was how I left. You know, she was a violent philosopher. But for, you know, an introverted, reflective child like me, it was the right question to leave. And I spent the next 50 years really wondering if happy, normal, normal, happy was a real binary, like good, evil, black, white, male, female, or whether it was an invented question. And I finally realised, of course, it's an invented question. You know, it's not a binary. It's not an opposition. But it was an interesting thing to work with. You know, it's a self-defining kind of question, isn't it?
Well, the memoir is mainly concerned with your early life, and then at the end, the happiness that you found with Susie Orbach, and eventually contact with your birth mother. What gave you the urge to write this memoir?
It was writing me. Sometimes you are powerfully overtaken by a book, and you have to do it. You know, it's a volcanic force which really can't be stopped. This would blow you apart, I think, if you tried to stop it up. When I found some documents after my father died, which led me to believe that my birth mother was alive, I had no idea this could be the case, because Mrs. Winterson had invented so many mothers for me: bad mothers, mad mothers, you know, dead mothers, drugged mothers, exploding mothers. So no sense that there was a biomar out there. Anyway, and then there became this kind of detective journey, really, of me trying to piece it all together and work it out. So this naturally led me to think about Winterson World again. So for my own purposes, I started writing that past. And then in 2 weeks, I'd done 15,000 words. The thing had such a momentum. And I thought, there's a lot here and it might actually help people. It's an interesting story. It's not the story of Oranges, although, you know, there are parallels, similarities. And then we go forward into what is really this detective story of, will I find Biomar and what will happen when I do find her?
I think that's interesting that you've sort of focused on the early part of your life and then the late. And you almost write like a little interlude, don't you? Say, right, I'm going to skip forward now.
Yeah, well, I borrowed that from Shakespeare, from The Winter's Tale, you know, because in the Shakespeare play, in the interval, time appears, we're carrying an hourglass, typical Elizabethan trope, and says, while you were out, 16 years passed, and now Perdita, the abandoned baby's grown up, and let's go and see what's happened. And when I was writing Why Be Happy, I thought, I want to miss out 25 years. And I thought, well, I've got a precedent. So I just had one page that was called Intermission, and it said, now I'm going to miss out 25 years. And I thought, it's my book, I can do this.
Absolutely. Yeah. If it was a black and white film, there'd be whirling newspapers and hands of a clock going round.
Yeah, there would. There would. And then we'd be in the next world. But I didn't want to get into all the bits in the middle, because it was Why Be Happy is the story of two mothers. One overwhelming by her presence and the other overwhelming by her absence. So the bit in the middle was not essential.
So at what point in your life did you discover opera? Because you've chosen two bits of opera for us.
Mm. I'd have chosen all opera, but I thought I'd be a bit more varied in my diet. I came to it quite late in life, actually. I was 30, and the first thing I saw was Turandot at Covent Garden, which was incredible. A friend said to me, well, start with Puccini and probably you'll come back to Puccini once you've been snobbish and forgotten about him in the middle when you're doing your Strauss and your Wagner. All true. So the second one I saw was Tosca, and because that was the old production, which still had the same costumes Maria Callas had worn. And, you know, this extraordinary aria, which if you're an artist, if you're a writer, I live for art, I live for love. I thought, that's me. I love it that she takes the breath there. It's like the handprint on the pot. She's not trying to pretend that this is a seamless performance. You know, this is gut. This is heart. You know, this is soul. This is body as well as throat and vocal cords. You know, you feel that the rawness is there as well as the sublime concentration and expertise.
I think you've summed up the power of Maria Callas very well there, Jeanette. And we heard her in the title role of Tosca. That was Vissi d'Arte from Act Two. And Georges Prêtre conducted the French National Radio Orchestra. And that's music chosen for us today by my guest, Jeanette Winterson. The words of that aria, I lived for art, I live for love. Does that mean that one must suffer? Does suffering always come with that, do you think?
Oh, of course. Suffering's part of life. Listen, suffering is fine, but it's only fine if you're suffering legitimately, by which I mean suffer for the thing that's actually hurting you. Lots of people suffer illegitimately. You know, they can't face the thing that is hurting them, so they deflect it into all kinds of other things, and then they become kind of neurotic and crazy. You know, you need to take your suffering head on and be brave about it, you know, and hearts are made to be broken. You know, it really upsets me that so many kids now, when they're struggling at 18, 19, even younger, you know, they go to the doctor and they get put on some sort of Prozac or some serotonin uptake inhibitor. It's like, you know, you can't feel anything. You must block that out. You know, you can't be abject and in some sense breaking down, but you have to. That's the way that you build yourself up and that you know yourself again. And nobody can be involved in art, you know, or in love, you know, any of that, because love is as creative as art is, and not know what it means to suffer.
And the voice of Callas just puts that over, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All of that edge, that catch in her voice.
All that matters is you shouldn't be afraid.
Well, Jeanette, you've said how important you think it is to move art forwards, that art should develop just the same as science does. And yet people like writers and artists and musicians as well to come up with more of the same. Why do you think there is this innate conservatism in the arts world, or maybe in the world at large, that's sort of imposed upon artists?
We all love what's familiar. It's not that we have contempt for it. It's just that it's warm, it's cosy, it makes us feel good about ourselves. But at the same time, recognise that, you know, a new generation has to make it new, and that we want to be part of that. You know, you don't want to be sort of rigid and just caught in the backflow all the time. You want to be forward, see what's happening, what's changing. So I always say to people, look, you don't have to like it, but go out there and expose yourself to it. And if you don't like it, ask yourself why. And if you do, fine. You know, it's all right to love something and not know why you love it. But if you don't like it, then you really have to ask yourself a few questions and say, you know, OK, maybe it's trash and maybe I'm right. Or maybe it's me that's got a problem with this piece of work. So, you know, and that's the way we expand the self that we are, always by involving ourselves in new experiences, new possibilities. So, you know, look, these choices here, lots of them, you know, they're all beautiful music. And in music, I do go for beauty because I get challenged in literature and on the stage. I get it when I go and look at visual art. You know, I want to be challenged and confronted. I guess in music, you know, I am more conservative because that for me is a place where I know I want to go home at the end of the day and just listen to this and find beauty. But I also make myself go to lots of new music so that I can hear things differently. You know, my friend the cellist Natalie Klein says you have to keep educating your ears. She's right.
Well, Jeanette, thank you very much for joining me today. I look forward very much to the next of our conversations.
Thank you.
You're tuned to BBC Radio 3 and Essential Classics with me, Sarah Walker, with you till Composer of the Week at midday. And I'm delighted to be joined by my guest this week, choosing her favourite classical music, the writer Jeanette Winterson. Jeanette, you were brought up in a strictly religious household. In fact, you say you were trained to be a missionary by your adoptive mother. What exactly were her ambitions for you?
Oh, she thought I should go off to hot places where she'd never been herself and spread the word. When she adopted me, she was looking for a child given to her by God. And when things went horribly wrong, which they did quite quickly, she used to say, "The devil led us to the wrong crib." So she really felt that she'd been deceived and that somewhere, you know, in the Cold War and McCarthyism, that Satan had personally visited Manchester, purpose of visit to deceive Mrs. Winterson. That I was like one of those fairy story changeling childs where you thought you were going to get a beautiful princess and actually you've got some scary goblin who's going to jump up and bite you. So the battle was continually between us about who I was, which was really about who she was, because she all her kind of lost ambitions and miseries and difficulties began somehow funneled into this little person that was me. And it had to go her way, which of course it couldn't because of all the people to adopt. She got one who was actually quite strong-willed and I wanted to do things my way.
Mm. And did music play any part in this religious training that she gave you?
Yes, it did. You know, evangelicals love music. There's lots of singing, lots of piano. It was part of our daily diet. You know, we went to church every day. It wasn't just on Sundays. And there was also at that time in the 60s in the north, you know, both pub traditions of singing. You'd always walk past a pub and the door would be open and somebody would be in there belting it out, you know, with some out of tune honky tonk in the background. And women used to sing on the streets when they were cleaning the windows or, you know, mopping the steps. It was, that's what I mean about it being both an oral culture and a more outgoing culture. There was a life of community and that included song. So it's always been very natural to me to have the human voice singing.
And now do you find that you can disconnect music from religion? I mean, the first piece we're going to hear today, The Protecting Veil, by a very religious composer, John Taverner. Mm. Do you have a problem with that at all?
Not at all. Look, if something's been huge in your early life, like a religious upbringing, and you decide to turn away from it, either you can get really angry and repudiate everything that's around it, but then you're cutting yourself off probably from a huge amount of Western art and culture and civilization, you know, whether it's pictures, literature, or particularly music. And you have to find the beauty that's there, the power that's there, and the spiritual uplift. You know, there is such a thing as the soul. We all know what we mean when we say he's got soul or she's soulless or they've sold their soul. We, you know, we understand that. And as far as I'm concerned, life has an inside as well as an outside. And we're just focused on this 24/7 crazy world of getting and spending. And the inside of life is often neglected rather than protected. And spiritual music can really look to that place. And I think John Taverner is somebody who does protect the soul.
The first movement from The Protecting Veil by Sir John Taverner. Yo-Yo Ma was the cellist and David Zinman conducted the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Music chosen specially for today's programme by my guest, the writer Jeanette Winterson. You actually met Sir John Taverner, didn't you, Jeanette?
I did. I was doing a special programme with Andrew Marr for Start the Week and John Taverner was the guest. And he was wonderful to be with. He did have an ethereal quality, but also one of great centeredness and content. And I felt that I was with someone who was rather special. It was like being with the Dalai Lama. You know, but the strange thing was that my partner, Susie Orbach, heard the programme and she said, he sounds like he's dead. And I said, what do you mean he was so alive? She said, no, I don't mean he was boring or dull. She said, I just mean he sounds like he's dead. And within the week, he was.
How strange.
Very strange. Mm. And it was as though he was transparent, I guess. He was already passing to some other place. It was an odd thing looking back on it now. Somebody who was so unafraid to be spiritual and believed absolutely in the protecting veil. And, you know, there's a time when, you know, ISIS is bombing the place to bits and you've got paedophile priests and then you've got conscience Christians refusing to give gay couples licences in Kentucky. You know, religion's taken quite a beating. And, you know, we have to kind of look through that and think about spirituality and that it has a place in all of our lives. You know, from someone from my kind of background, that's really important to try and separate off the spiritual side of our natures, which I believe is real and is fed by art, music, away from, you know, this sort of thundering prejudice where human beings elevate hatred in the name of God.
And someone like Sir John Taverner is the ideal person to sort of bring you back in a way. I remember meeting him myself and what struck me was his amazing sense of humour.
Yeah.
He's quite a mischievous man, not an easy man to interview. I don't think he answered any of my questions. But on the other hand, I had such a wonderful time being with him, his warmth and his humanity and a sort of naughty subversiveness about him that I really liked.
He was an iconoclast and he simply wrote the music he wanted to write in his own way, which I really admire, and he wasn't afraid of being spiritual.
Well, we've a song next, Jeanette, that you chose by that slightly mysterious British composer Peter Warlock, whose colourful name was actually a pseudonym reflecting his interest in occult practices. His real name was Philip Heseltine. And the title of the piece we'll hear is Sleep, always a fascinating subject for poets and composers. Why does it fascinate you?
I love sleeping and I'm very good at it, much to the envy and disgust of my friends and my partner Susie. If it's not 9 hours a night, I'm not worth knowing. And sleep for me is also part of being creative, because I wake up and I have good ideas and I've usually solved problems, and I have to allow that cusp and that threshold to happen between waking and sleeping. You know, other cultures really revere that space, that we don't just jump out of bed when the alarm clock goes off and, you know, shove down the cornflakes and belt into the real world, that you have time. So I try and stretch that moment. I do meditation in the morning. For me, it is part of knowing where your imaginative capacities lie.
Well, let's hear it now. Peter Warlock's song Sleep. John Mark Ainsley is the tenor with Roger Vignoles at the piano. Peter Warlock's song Sleep. John Mark Ainsley was the tenor with Roger Vignoles at the piano. Jeanette, have you written about sleep in any of your books?
Not directly, I don't think. Perhaps because it belongs to me. It's part of my life as a writer rather than the lives of my characters. No.
That's an interesting thing to think about, how a character would sleep and whether that would tell you anything about the character, the way they sleep.
Lots about dreams and the dream state and the dream world, but not about just being asleep. But it is a great luxury. It's one of my absolute pleasures. You know, when I'm not physically writing, you know, I like running, I like gardening, I like reading and I like sleeping.
Wonderful. Well, tomorrow, Jeanette, we'll have music by Peter Maxwell Davies, Billy Bragg and Gluck. So I look forward to that. But for now, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm Sarah Walker and this is Essential Classics on BBC Radio 3. My guest this week, sharing her favourite classical music, is the writer Jeanette Winterson. Jeanette, you moved over 20 years ago to the countryside. What was it that propelled you out to the country?
Craziness of London. I mean, I have a place in London still. I'm very lucky because I'm allowed to have two lives. But I just couldn't stand the rush and the pace of it anymore, and I thought it wasn't helping me to work. You know, I like to have a lot of time to myself, and I like to go out for a walk and talk to myself out loud without being arrested or people looking at me like I'm a psychopath. You know, and in the Cotswolds, I can do that. And I love the land. You know, I have a deep connection, you know, with the soil. I grow my own vegetables. You know, I'm happy when I'm in the garden. I go into kind of alpha wave state because when we were kids, you know, we had an allotment and I learned how to grow vegetables from being 5 years old on. So the whole business of it is so deep in me that I can do it without thinking. And that's real relaxation. So to get up every morning in that beautiful place, you know, with the birds and the country, the foxes, the badgers, you know, that's life.
And I'm sure many townies dream of that sort of life, but it's not for everybody, is it?
Absolutely not, no. Look, my partner's Jewish. She's an urban Jew, and she doesn't know what the country's for. And I really understand that. You know, it's got to be what suits you and you know, what kind of life it is that feeds you, what kind of life you want, and then to see if you can find that for yourself.
Mm. Well, your first music today relates to a place in the British Isles. It's somewhere that's far from the Cotswolds, I admit, but is there any connection for you to this place?
No, not to the place. I love Peter Maxwell Davies' music, and this is something which seems to me, it starts so simply as though it's a child's exercise on the piano, and then it builds, and you know, the whole thing grows into this really cheerful kind of crescendo, I suppose, of just English, Scottish folk music coming together where people simply, you know, made their own fun, their own entertainment, and playing and singing was a part of life, not some rarefied middle-class activity that only a few people do, but something that everybody does. And I sometimes think that we've sort of been cut off from that sense of art being in all our lives, always, forever, whether people were reciting poems or putting on little shows or, you know, painting pictures. And if you think about kids, that's what they do. You know, every child that's born wants to sing or, you know, use the kitchen table as a pair of bongos, you know, paint a picture, stick it on the fridge. And then we talk about art as some sort of elitist activity. It's madness. Something in this song that just makes me feel, yeah, this is for everybody.
Well, let's hear it now. It's called Farewell to Stromness by Peter Maxwell Davies, who moved to the Orkneys in 1971 after establishing himself as a leading member of the avant-garde in England. Since then, quite a few of his works have strong links to their Orcadian environment, and this one highlights one of its principal towns. And playing it here, the composer himself. Peter Maxwell Davies playing his own composition, Farewell to Stromness, music by an English composer devoted to the musical traditions of the Orkneys and chosen for us today by my guest Jeanette Winterson. Max's own playing makes such a difference, doesn't it, on that track?
I love it. You know, I wish we could get some of our amateurishness back, you know, because it comes from, you know, the root of that is to love something. Just the idea that, you know, you might not be the world's best pianist, but you want to play anyway. You know, that we would just do it and join in. And that's what you get, the sense of that. Somebody's front room, isn't it? Just playing this great tune. And it's a shame now, you know, like with X Factor and The Voice and Britain's Got Talent. Somehow it's all got to be about, you know, I'm going to make a professional career out of this. This, you know, this is my dream, follow it. No, it's just complete hyper rubbish. But the idea that you might just do it for love and for pleasure amongst your own friends, you know, that's what's missing. We need that back.
You don't have to be a career musician, do you, to take part in music?
No. And, you know, Ian Forster, the novelist, used to say, look, you should play something badly just so that you know what it takes to play something well. Mm. You know, so that when you go to a concert, you know, you really have an appreciation, you know, for the effort and the skill and the practice, the 10,000 hours, you know, that people put into this at that high level.
Well, the music we've just heard, I think, bridges the gap between classical and folk music. And the next piece you've chosen is also a modern take on folk. This is a Billy Bragg song. It's performed by Eliza Carthy and her band. I know you're fond of Englishness and the idea of Englishness. Would you say this is a classic example?
Yeah, I am fond of it. It interests me. It's something that really happened sort of around the First World War. There's a sort of poignancy in it. A love of Englishness, which isn't nationalism. And this is a crucial thing and a crucial difference. You know, we don't need any more nationalism in the world. But we do want a sense of identity, you know, which is not about a flag waving, you know, or hating other people, being xenophobic or worrying about migrants. You know, it's about, you know, what makes this country, this people, who they are, and how do we express that, you know, but not just in our high art, but in our folk art. And, you know, with Liza Carthy, I love her voice. You know, I guess I heard her singing first, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago on the radio. And I just thought, who is this? This is fantastic.
And the title of the song, it's called King James Version. Mm. So is the significance in that religious reference there?
Yeah, we're back to religious references, religious music. Yeah, and the King James Bible, you know, brought up on. That it does mean something to me. Yeah, I think your past has to mean something to you. Not in a slavish way, you know. You can't be lost there or enthralled to it. But you have to bring it with you because it's who you are. You know, this. And when you get to, you know, in your 50s, which I am now, you can probably see to the end of your life and you can look back the other way. So it's a very interesting midpoint. And you think, I want it all. I want this to balance. You know, I'm not going to repudiate anything. Just give it to me.
Billy Bragg's song King James Version with Eliza Carthy as both vocalist and fiddle player, and the Ratcatchers, John Bowden playing the guitar, Ben Ivitsky viola, John Spears melodeon, and the voice of Heather MacLeod. Thank you to my guest, Jeanette Winterson, for choosing that song for us. What a great voice, as you were saying yourself,
great
Jeanette.
Voice. And you know, there's all this talk now about how we just have to have our 5 a day or our 12 a day, and we need variety to keep our gut going. You know, we need variety full stop. And, you know, I'm not interested, you know, when people say, oh, I only want to listen to this, you know, whether it's modern music, contemporary music, classical music, you know, don't narrow yourself down, open yourself up and have as much as possible. You know, it's this business of educating your ears, because there's always going to be something out there you'll find that you think, wow, that's fantastic. You know, suppose I hadn't come to opera when I was 30, suppose I'd said opera's not for me. You know, I'd have lost that fantastic richness of experience. I'd hate that. And the same with her, you know, just hearing things differently and hearing things new, you know, while we've got this life. God, you know, we're dead soon enough.
It's like the rainbow, the idea of eating a rainbow. You can listen to a rainbow as well. Well, from one very beautiful voice to another, because this next song features the legendary contralto Kathleen Ferrier, who was from your part of the world. So was she something of a role model, perhaps?
Well, Mrs. Winston loved Kathleen Ferrier, the telephonist who won a singing competition and then went on to be this, you know, world-class contralto, always keeping, you know, her Lancashire roots. Yes, I mean, and Mrs. Winston used to play Kathleen Ferrier songs on the piano and sing along. You know, I love that. You know, she was our Kathleen, and that identification was important. And again, you know, not high or low, you know, forget whether it's classical or it's not. You know, you'd hear people singing Kathleen Ferrier in the pub.
So this aria by Gluck, Kathleen Ferrier's party piece, expressing the despair of Orpheus having lost his beloved Eurydice, how deeply does this touch you?
It's a beautiful piece of music, and you know, I am affected by loss. I'm always imagining how I'll feel, you know, when people that I care for very deeply are gone, you know, and I have already had some of those losses in my life. And that sense that you never can bring them back, and this is the ultimate fantasy, that somehow you can go down into the underworld and draw them back through into the world of light. But you can't, you know, because they live deep within you after that. They can't live in the visible world at all. And I think music is very good at both conveying that utter despair, sadness, sorrow, and also this strange hope against hope that all of us have, that somehow we'll see our loved ones again.
Che farò senza Eurydice from Act 3 of the opera Orfeo ed Eurydice by Gluck. Kathleen Ferrier was the contralto, with Charles Brook conducting the orchestra of the Netherlands Opera. Jeanette Winterson, thinking back to your adoptive mother playing and singing that aria, as you're telling us, was there an emotional element there that she wouldn't allow from anywhere else? You know, did it allow her to perhaps express emotions that she couldn't do any other way?
Yes, she didn't do emotions unless it was explosive anger. This was a woman who kept a revolver in the duster drawer and the bullets in a tin of pledge. So we were never quite sure if we were going to be murdered. I mean, she did fire it once through the kitchen window. She'd had it in the war. You see, this is important because my parents were older when they adopted me, and they'd both lived through the war. My father was a corporal in the army. And so their experience of that, you know, was absolutely real. So, you know, with somebody like Kathleen Ferrier, who was their generation, you know, it was like being in that world for me as a child of the 60s. I was somehow living in the war with them. You know, she still had her war cupboard where she just put tins in case it all happened again. She never quite thought it wouldn't, which makes sense in a way. First World War, Second World War. Why wouldn't there be another one? You think of the war ending in 1945, and in 1946, Glyndebourne Opera decide to commission a completely new opera by the young composer Benjamin Britten. It ends up being The Rape of Lucretia, with Kathleen Ferrier in the title role. And that seems to me, you know, what fighting the war was absolutely about, that level of civilization, that we would go on commissioning operas, having great singers, and that we'd all get dressed up and go and listen to them, even though we were all eating Spam and having half an ounce of butter every week.
I'm very curious to know why she fired the gun through the kitchen window.
She was furious. Yes, yes. When she lost her temper, there was always this threat that she would do something very violent indeed. So this was a woman with a suppressed and smouldering personality. She'd go for days not speaking, and then the gun would come out, and then maybe the tin of pledge would come out with the bullets in it, and then the bullets would go in the gun, and we never knew what was going to happen. And one day she just ripped off and fired it through the window. I think she'd been in the Home Guard. She was a pretty good shot.
And she was a big lady, wasn't she?
Took out the bird table. Yeah.
And you were small.
20 stone, 5'10". Yeah. So, you know, I've always been tiny. So there was this physical disparity between us, and also this huge looming character who was larger than life and quite frightening.
And I'm curious to know how you reacted as well when the piano we've been talking about that she played was replaced by an electronic organ.
Oh. Yeah, well, it was an old upright with candelabra and pitted keys, you know, the kind of thing that you could just have up against the wall. She used to put it on the wall right next door to the neighbours because, as far as she was concerned, they were the heathen and they were drunks. So she used to wait till they'd been out all night boozing and then start bashing out hymns through the wall, you know, to enrage them and wake them up. She was that kind of woman. And yeah, we did finally get rid of it. I'd gone to Oxford by then and I came back and I could hear this like bass and cymbal coming through the window, you know, houses straight onto the street, no privacy. I thought, what is she doing? And I looked in and she got this giant electronic organ, you know, with all the kit that she was playing. So she was sort of doing in the bleak midwinter, you know, with a kind of bossa nova bass to it. She had a sense of humour as well as the explosive rage. And she thought that was progress. She'd also built her own CB radio and she was broadcasting to the heathen of Manchester to change their ways. Quite a woman to live up to. The only thing you could really do was go.
Were you allowed to play around on this organ yourself?
No, she was very possessive as well. Anything to do with a keyboard belonged to her. She wanted me to play the violin, which I absolutely hated. You know, I was never going to be an Eliza Carthy. Though I think maybe I should take it up again now, given that I'd spend years doing it. And maybe I could just learn to do some folk tunes. What do you think?
I think you could.
Yeah, I think I should
definitely
have a go.
Yeah, you should, if not get an actual piano to have in your front room.
Well, and after all these years. Yeah, because we used to play everything by ear. Mrs. Winterson was self-taught.
Well, good luck if
Thank you
decide to take that up. And many thanks for joining me today, Jeanette. I look forward to tomorrow when we'll have music by John Adams and Handel.
Fantastic.
You're listening to Essential Classics on BBC Radio 3 with me, Sarah Walker. My guest this week, choosing some of her favourite classical music, is a writer whose first novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, was an immediate bestseller. Since then, she's published many more books, including one that's just out, The Gap of Time. She's Jeanette Winterson. Jeanette, you've chosen two pieces of opera for us in today's programme. Could you ever imagine writing a libretto for an opera?
Yeah, I think that would be quite interesting. I mean, one of my children's books, The Lion, the Unicorn and Me, has been made into an opera. I didn't do the libretto. Francesca Zambello commissioned it and directed it for the Washington State Opera. So it was pretty exciting. But, you know, I thought there's a real skill to this libretto business because you don't want too many words, do you? You want to get out of the way. You know, in Strauss's opera Capriccio, there's that argument between words and music, which is more important. And they decide in the end it's a kind of balance. I'm not sure. And it's one reason why I don't really like listening to opera in English unless it's written in English, because I like the music to just take over and I don't have to worry too much about the language. So I'd have to do something that was really spare and that was pushing always into kind of something epigrammatic, elliptical, open, so that the music could come through. That would interest me. But nothing dense, you know. I don't want to do a narrative with music behind it.
Well, the first music you've chosen today certainly has an interesting text. It's taken from one of the Holy Sonnets of John Donne. But the theme of the work itself is more modern. It's an aria from the opera Dr. Atomic by John Adams, which focuses on the great stress and anxiety experienced by those at Los Alamos while the test of the first atomic bomb was being prepared. Have you actually seen this opera live?
Yes, I saw it when it was at the ENO. Again, because I'm interested in seeing new opera. I think it's an art form which should continue. You know, it's not absurd. You know, it's glorious. It's huge. It's, you know, it's ridiculous. I love that wraparound sound, all those people. You know, the scale of it, I think, is so impressive. But we do need to allow people to go on making new work. And, it, you know, it's essential. You can't just do the 18th and 19th century repertoires all of the time. You have to risk it and see what classical composers now want to do with the form, which is bound to be exciting. And I thought this was incredible. But what I would say is my own rule is, you know, with new work, go and see it on the stage before you listen to it. You know, most people, I guess, may be more sophisticated than me. But if I see it, then I can get it and then I can listen to it later.
Well, the whole point of opera is that you go and see it.
I think
so. It's a theatrical form.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I don't like seeing it at the cinema. I like seeing, you know, the real live performance. And, you know, when I had no money, I just used to stand up at the back and now I can afford to sit down.
Well, the aria you asked for, Jeanette, is called Batter My Heart. It's from the end of Act One. It's sung by the physicist Oppenheimer, who's sometimes referred to as the father of the atomic bomb. So what's happening at this point in the drama?
It's scary and it's sad because Oppenheimer is in love with the physics, you know, the godlike possibilities of what you can do if you explode the atom. But he's also realising what the enormous human cost of this is going to be. And it's almost as though he's experiencing the human cost, that, you know, the huge scale of it. He knows where the targets are going to be. He's seen all that. He knows how many people are going to be ruined when this bomb is let off. And so he kind of detonates himself. He's fragmenting, he's exploding, he's dying. And he sings this aria from John Donne, really just saying, just rip me up, rip me apart, do to me what I'm about to do to others, what I'm doing to the structure of the universe itself. You know, it's such a dramatic moment, and it's at the interval. And you leave. I left, you know, I was actually sweating. I couldn't speak. I was so moved by this piece.
And Gerald Finley is the baritone.
Mm.
Batter My Heart from Act One of Dr. Atomic by John Adams. Gerald Finley was the baritone, with Edward Gardner conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Mm. Well, let's move on now from opera to your art form, Jeanette, writing, and your latest book, The Gap of Time, based on The Winter's Tale, which is one of Shakespeare's final plays. You described it as a cover version, which I'm sure many musicians will relate to. How was the idea sparked off?
It's a big project. Look, next year is 2016, so it's going to be Bardomania in Britain as we go for the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, you know, our national hero. And the idea was to get writers from around the world to pick a play they had a connection to and to write it as a novel. And some of us have. You know, Margaret Atwood's doing The Tempest. I think Anne Tyler's doing Taming of the Shrew. Jo Nesbo is doing Macbeth as a kind of police procedure detective novel. And I just wanted to do The Winter's Tale. As soon as they asked me, I thought, that's my play.
And why did you feel that was yours?
Well, it's got an abandoned baby in it, isn't it? I mean, it's as obvious as that. Mm. You know, when I was growing up, I was looking for stories that had foundlings in them, abandoned babies. You know, there's lots of us and we do very well. Spider-Man, Superman, you know, Han Solo in the Star Wars stuff, you know, Tom Jones in the novel. But I was looking for clues, signs, symbols, something that would tell me about myself. Because if you're adopted, it's like going in after curtain up or reading a book with the first few pages missing. There's a mystery around your origins, you know, and this story really deals with that, because there's an abandoned baby as its shining centre. You know, it's a tale of jealousy. You know, typical male rage, thinks his wife's having an affair with his best friend, decides the baby isn't his, throws it out to be looked after by kites, ravens, wolves and bears. And of course, the child herself grows up to be a lovely woman and begins to be part of the redemption of the play. You know, The Winter's Tale is a play about redeeming time. You know, we usually think that the future depends on the past. That's the normal way that time's arrow goes. But in The Winter's Tale, time's reversible. And really, the past is dependent on the future to be healed. Just like, you know, we've heard in Dr. Atomic, you can do something so destructive that it will take years, if ever, to repair. And what Shakespeare's saying is, okay, destroy it overnight if you want. Look how long it's going to take you to fix it. But you can, because this is a world of second chances and forgiveness.
Well, I'd love you to read an excerpt from the book, Jeanette, if you would. We have a scene with Perdita, who's the lost and found child. She's now nearly 18, and her adopted father, who at the start of the story found her in a baby chute in a hospital in New Bohemia, which is a sort of fantasy New York. So if you'd like to read, that would be fantastic, Jeanette.
Perdita went out into the garden. Her father was watching the buzzards wing level with the wind. "Happy birthday, Dad." He put his arm round her. "I have something for you." "For me? It's your birthday, not mine." Out of his pocket, Shep pulled a soft, worn leather pouch. "This came from your mother. I was waiting till you turned 18, but instead I turned 70. Didn't want to drop dead and not give this to you myself."
"You're not dropping dead, Dad."
"Here." Shep emptied the contents of the pouch in her hands. Perdita sat silently, looking at the shining cold fire beauty, the making of the world, a layer of time. Because that's what diamonds are.
"Are they real?"
"Sure. Diamonds all the way." "She wasn't poor, then?" "I don't reckon she was a poor woman, no." Perdita was holding the diamonds that her mother had held, as her mother must once have held her, in both hands. She started to cry.
"Don't cry," said Shep. "You were loved then, and you are loved now. Isn't that enough?"
Perdita nodded and wiped her eyes with the back of her hand. She was at that age when sometimes she was a grown woman, and sometimes she was still a kid.
Thank you, Jeanette.
Thank you.
How well you read. Is that something that comes naturally to you, reading out loud?
Yes, I guess it is. It's all those Bible readings and back in the oral tradition of the church. You know, you would always stand up and read the Bible and tell stories from the Bible. And also, you know, when I'm writing, I read out loud to myself as I write, because, you know, you can cheat the eye, but you can't cheat the ear. The ear will tell you if you've got your rhythm wrong, and if you've got the whole balance of the sentence wrong. You know, for me, writing is like building a dry stone wall, which is something else that I do. This is the physical process of it. And if you don't get it level, you just have to take it back down to the point where it is. You can't just fix it. You know, the whole kind of cut and paste thing that computers allow, you know, it's seductive, but it's nonsense. Mm-hmm. You have to take the thing back down to where it's good and then build it up again. And when you read it out loud, you really find that. And, you know, and remember, with a dry stone wall, there's no mortar or cement in there. It's strong because it has the gaps in, so the wind blows through rather than knocks it down. So we're back to this idea of breath. I love that, the idea of the wind, the spirit, just that movement of the mouth and that connection between the mouth and the ear. To me, that's what language is.
Well, let's move on now from your modern take on Shakespeare to a recent recording of an 18th century opera, because you've chosen music by Handel for us, part of Alcina. Why does this music draw you in?
Well, I love Handel. Alcina's a great opera. I've only ever seen it once because it's not very often performed. And the 18th century fascinates me. You know, in London, I have a little 18th century house. It was very dilapidated when I bought it. It had a dangerous structure notice nailed on the door the day after I did buy it, which was, you know, a little disappointing. It was the time when the whole place was just full of rats and there was nothing there. The old fruit and veg market was going, and tramps used to light great big bonfires at the corner outside my window. So it was a lawless land outside the city walls, as it always was, you know, in the days of Shakespeare. That's where you go if you had something to hide. So I kind of liked it. I thought, I'm a bit of a bandit and an outlaw. That's where I should have a house. So the 18th century is resonant to me, and because also it has a kind of optimism and chutzpah that you sort of lose in the 19th century, where, in fact, for all the empire building and progress, everybody becomes full of doubt and uncertainty, and they don't know if they believe in God or themselves or masculinity or anything like that. You know, it's an anguish century, whereas the 18th century has just got a bit more liveliness to it, I think. I can't stand the Victorians.
Well, let's hear the aria now, Verdi Prati, Green Meadows, from Act Two of Alcina, an opera with a theme of magic in its various forms. Alcina is a sorceress living on an island, mistress of all she surveys, until she meets the hero, Ruggiero. But he clocks onto her evil powers, and he realises he must leave, though he admits the island will haunt him for the rest of his life. Sarah Connolly is the mezzo-soprano, and Harry Christophers conducts a symphony of harmony and invention.
Thank you.
Sarah Connolly was the mezzo-soprano and Harry Christophers conducted the Symphony of Harmony and Invention in that aria from Handel's Alcina, Verdi Prati, Green Meadows. And that's music chosen for us by my guest, Jeanette Winterson. A possible choice for you to have at your funeral, Jeanette?
Absolutely. I've written all the instructions, you know, because I'm a control freak. I think all adopted children are. I mean, look what happened the one time we weren't in control. So, you know, I want to make sure that my exit is at least, you know, something that I've been able to deal with beforehand. So that's absolutely there because it's a beautiful aria. You know, and Sarah Connolly does it so well. You know, I've seen her in lots of productions and she has such power. And of course, she always plays those trouser roles. You know, sometimes she's playing a boy, a man. Sometimes she's a voluptuous woman. You know, and that's quite sexy. I mean, the 18th century opera is very good at that. All that cross-dressing, all that gender confusion. You know, the Victorians hated it, of course. And it's something, you know, that's come back now. You know, just as it was in Shakespeare's day where, you know, women weren't on the stage, so you'd always have a boy playing a girl. But then, confusingly, you'd have a boy playing a girl playing a boy. You know, and the audience are in on this. You know, so you have an extra level, really, of erotic possibility.
It's great fun. Well, Jeanette, thank you so much for talking to me today. I look forward to our next conversation when we'll have two recordings by the cellist Natalie Klein. Mm. One recording, a very special one, and I'll be choosing a piece for you too.
Thank you.
You're tuned to BBC Radio 3 and Essential Classics with me, Sarah Walker, with you till Composer of the Week at midday. And I'm delighted to be joined once again by my guest this week, the writer Jeanette Winterson, who's sharing her favourite classical music with us. Jeanette, you've written books for children as well as adults. I think Tangle Wreck was the first one. And when you write children's books, are you also partly writing for the adults who might be reading them out loud, perhaps?
Definitely. Because one of the things children love is to have stories read out loud to them. Again, because for them, you know, language is alive. It's not silent reading. So, you know, I love the sense that you can make up a story as you go along too, so you don't have to stick to the text on the page. You know, that happened to me when I was growing up with Mrs. Winterson, because books weren't allowed in the house, but she did read Jane Eyre to me. I think that was deemed suitable because it's got a minister in it, St. John Rivers, who's keen on missionary work. But in the version that Mrs. Winterson read, after the terrible fire at Thornfield Hall, Jane doesn't bother about her now sightless paramour, Mr. Rochester. She goes off and she marries St. John Rivers. And it was only later when I read it myself that I realised what Mrs. Winterson had done, that she'd just turned the pages and invented the text extempore as she went along. So this gave me a good basis for being a fiction writer, and it's something I've always brought into my work. But with kids, often if I'm reading them a story that exists, you know, whether it's Cinderella or Rumpelstiltskin or anything like that, I'll just make things up and add them myself too.
Do you think it's important that adults stay in touch with the childlike part of themselves?
Absolutely. You have to be able to go on playing, which is, you know, interesting. We're talking about music today. You know, we call it playing, don't we? And that's what it is. You know, it's that part of you which isn't ground down, you know, by your daily duties and responsibilities, that, you know, isn't about getting and spending, about the life you lead. You know, it's releasing the soul, the joy, the pleasure that you are. Of course we should play.
Well, you also work with young people as Professor of Creative Writing at Manchester University. Do you enjoy the teaching?
Yeah, and I didn't think I would. A, because I don't believe in creative writing courses, and I still don't. And B, because I wasn't sure if I would be any good at it. And in fact, I just threw myself in and I thought, you know, I want them to be excited. I want to communicate, you know, all the possibilities of language, what they can do with it. You know, what a marvellous medium this is for expression, you know, something that we've developed, not just so that we can exchange information, but so that we can talk about difficult things, you know, how to live, who to love, how to manage betrayal, death, you know, the big questions. And for that, you need a robust, supple, strong language. And that's what I'm trying to get across to people. You know, there's nothing elitist about having language at the highest level. If you deprive people of language, of course, they're going to throw a brick through a window or set fire to a car. You know, we're not supposed to be inarticulate. We're supposed to be able to express ourselves. You know, and there's this kind of democratic rot, really, that somehow that's only for people who are well educated. But it's at the root of the problem. Language is for everybody.
Well, your first piece of music today, Jeanette, is by one of the big creative geniuses, J.S. Bach. And it's something you love so much that you had it played at your wedding earlier this year. Mm. So a rather special performance.
Fabulous. I got married to my partner, Susie Orbach, in June this year, and we were married at the Freud Museum, actually, in London, because we thought we could start couples therapy early. But we had Natalie come along to play. I've known Natalie for many years. She's a fantastic cellist, and she came to play this piece for us, so it will always be special to me.
Well, let's hear it now. The prelude from Bach's first cello suite in G major. And Natalie Klein actually came along to the Essential Classics studio to play this specially for you. So we're very grateful to her, and it's a wonderful performance. Here it is.
I feel like I've got married all over again. Do you know, there's nothing delicate about being a musician. There's delicacy in it, but, you know, you need the muscle strength of a butcher. You know, whenever I watch Natalie play, and you watch her arm muscles working, and the strength and the tension in the fingers. You know, this is a really physical activity. You know, all arts are physical activity. You know, there's nothing passive about it. And I think sometimes people forget this. You know, we're used to seeing great bands on stage, but we're not always used to seeing the vigour, the effort that classical musicians make when they're playing their instruments.
And what a fantastic piece to have at your wedding. I mean, it's difficult to choose the right piece, isn't it?
But yeah.
But that surely is so perfect. And I want to know now all about your wedding and what you wore, what Susie wore. Did you have confetti? Did you have all the traditional trappings? What did you do?
We didn't have confetti because it wasn't allowed. You know, this is the advertising break. I had a nice dress from Burberry because I wanted something quite fitted, and I think she had Dolce & Gabbana, so it was very glamorous. But you know, all our friends were there, and it was full of love and warmth as a wedding should be. And it was a Jewish wedding under a chuppah, which I made myself. I cut down poles from the wood. I live in a wood in the country, and we sewed the canopy, and we were married underneath it by a rabbi from a progressive church, Rebecca Quasenberg, and I rewrote the seven blessings so that they would be right for us. You know, you can do that with a Jewish ceremony. It's very enlightened. You know, the Jews really got it right.
Well, Natalie, after recording that piece for us, Natalie Klein, she also recommended a piece that she wanted you to hear as well. So I think we should hear that now. And this is something that she thought would be perfect to follow her playing of the Bach. It's music by Bloch, Ernest Bloch, a movement called Prayer from his triptych of 1924. It's called From Jewish Life. So joining Natalie Klein, we have the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra conducted by Ilan Volkov. Prayer by Ernest Bloch, a movement from his three-part orchestral suite From Jewish Life. The cellist was Natalie Klein, joined by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Ilan Volkov. And that was Natalie's choice for you, Jeanette Winterson.
A present to me.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, Natalie's a Jew. My wife, Susie Orbach's a Jew. I feel I've been sort of embraced by the Jewish community in a way which is lovely for me. And they have always running together, which you can hear it in that piece, this melancholy and also merriments. The melancholy is, you know, the promised land, you're never going to get there, it doesn't exist, you know, and the Jews don't believe in the afterlife in the way the Christian faith does. But that means you have to make the most of it in the here and now. You know, that just love of life. And, you know, another Jew, Harold Bloom, once translated the Jewish blessing as more life into a time without boundaries. Isn't that wonderful? More life into a time without boundaries. And I suppose that's what I'm always trying to work with myself. You know, I'm obsessed with time and how we can stretch it. I know, perhaps sometimes how we can reverse it. And, you know, Freud, another Jew, grandmaster of narrative, saying that, no, you have to go back in time, find the thing which is lost or stuck in order to release the present.
Well, after Natalie's choice for you, we now have my choice for you. So this
what a great
is something...
day for me. I mean, everybody's giving me music.
This is something I could tell you what it is if you like, or if you'd just like to what listen to it without knowing. Well, it's by Ravel, and it's an arrangement by Percy Grainger, because I went looking
for good.
Someone who's absolutely mad about doing transcriptions, and as you're a lover of cover versions.
I am.
And it also has some rather interesting sounds. It's a very unorthodox sort of arrangement. It's of Ravel's piece Miroir, La Vallée des Cloches.
Right. Well, I'll be putting that on my iPod. Pretty cool. Well done.
Thank you. I just instinctively thought you'd love music by Grainger. Well, that was an arrangement by Grainger. Just the unusual sounds, because you're open to new sounds. You like new things. But also the idea of him being so good at cover versions as he is. The piece was La Vallée des Cloches, which is the final movement of Miroir, his suite, originally a piano suite. It's from 1905, the last movement of the suite. It's dedicated to a group of friends who went by the name of the Apaches. They were a group of artistic outcasts, Ravel and his friends. So, Jeanette, looking to the future now, what are your feelings about the way the book business is going with e-books and self-publishing and so on?
It's healthy and it's interesting. What's clear is that people want to go on reading and they want to go on writing. You know, that's why you get a creative writing course springing up every 5 minutes everywhere. There seems to be, I suppose it's a point where we're becoming kind of more homogenised and people feel they actually have less freedom, that they want to know how to express themselves. And this is only a good thing, I think. It's this taking back of language, people wanting to tell their own stories in their own way, not have those stories told for them. I see that as positive. Look, the book itself is just, you know, it's beautiful and we love them, but it's a format. The point is that we need to go on communicating, telling those stories, those poems, you know, getting those ideas across. And beyond the ideas, the beauty of imagery and meaning and metaphor, all of that. However we manage to do it, as long as we keep culture alive, then we've succeeded. You know, it's if culture begins to fade away, that we're truly dead as human beings, because, you know, we're not androids. Robots can't take over the world. We're this strange hybrid creature. You know, we commit the worst atrocities imaginable. We're hateful. And yet there's also part of us that can play this music, can invent these things, these beauties, you know, this pursuit of beauty, which eludes us, but we can't give it up, can we? We still dream of a better life, a world where there'll be peace and harmony and we'll learn how to live together and not destroy the planet. And I think art in all its forms, in music, theatre, writing, pictures, it's all part of that process to say, you know, we are more than destruction, we're more than death, we're more than narrow politics. You know, art speaks across nations, across time, across cultures, across every divide, and draws us together. And to me, it makes life worth living.
Well, Jeanette Winston, you've been a fantastic guest. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
So those were my conversations with Jeanette Winterson. I do hope you enjoyed them. And if you'd like to listen to all the music Jeanette has chosen this week, just visit the BBC's Playlister. Follow the link on the Essential Classics homepage. And don't forget that you can subscribe to our guest interviews and then they'll be delivered directly to you each week. You can also go back and listen to past guests, including Sam Neill, John Lithgow, Robert Newman, Gene Spratland, and many more. Just visit the BBC website. Bye for now.